So tonight we turn to Kashmir Shaivism, its triadic philosophy, and its greatest exponent, Abhinavagupta. To this point, probably the most powerful philosophic school that has taken shape in India up to, say, 1000 CE would be correctly regarded as the Advaita Vedanta of Shankara. It helped in the displacement of Buddhistic schools and views, which had dominated much of India's principalities and cities through the exercise of royal power in urban settings. It does not seem that Buddhism ever penetrated deeply into the rural life of India, which continued as it had for millenniums. But Shankara was fighting a worldview with language similar to that which his opponents used. If Buddhism saw the world as a vast field of suffering, and we could not ascertain a beginning or an end to where the world came from, it wasn't even our point to ask a question like that, but rather to look into our nature, recognize what the elements of our existence are, and by striking off accretions of ego and desire, get back to the fundamental recognition that there is no measurable self here. And so our attachment to the world is wrong. It's a wrong view. And when you blow out that ego sense, you arrive at nirvana. What that is left undescribed. Shankara, as you know, replaced this view with an idea that the world is not a field of suffering, but the world is not fundamentally real. And using what in logic is an analogy based on the material cause, said that we regard the world as a walker might in dusk along the road and espy a rope and mistake it for a snake, and so we mistake what is veritable and what is real as being something which is moving and shifting. Shankara takes this rigid position because he accepts the Vedantic formula that all that is real is Brahman, and Brahman must be unimpeachable, must maintain its integrity at all points, must be pure, and so could never be associated with a world which is imperfect, with a world which has so many divisions and uglinesses in it. So, must be rejected then. And his means of doing that, which he argued forcefully for, brought Hindu philosophy back into dominance in India. A lot of people later said, look, this guy is a crypto-Buddhist. he's using Buddhism's arguments to apparently vanquish Buddhism, but it's the same thing. It establishes the world as being non-real. If it has any reality at all, it is only a relative reality. As long as you're in the dream seems real to you, but really there is no dream, there is no dreamer. there is only that pure Brahman, if you want to say, that pure self, Atman. Nothing else exists. So we have these two competing schools. Buddhism, as it developed, formed idealistic schools. Nagarjuna, Vasubandhu, primary among them, who stated that the world cannot be seen as being anything other than a void or than sheer consciousness. If Shankara's school of thought could be called illusionistic non-dualism, when we get to the Shaivism of Kashmir, we have a different perspective altogether. This is realistic non-dualism and affirms the reality of the world. This has profound consequences. It seems that some argue that it is not Shankara who drove Buddhism out of intellectual India, but rather the Trika philosophy of Kashmir, because it deals with the same problems of life and answers them more lucidly. Shankara has nothing to say to the common experience of life. But the thinkers in Kashmir and Abhinavagupta, coming at the problem from a different angle, offer another view. If Shankara uses the analogy of a rope and a snake to drive his argument, Kashmir Shaivism prefers the image of light. If you say that the divine is light and that there is a world, the world comes into being because the divine focuses that light into a ray. And the ray cannot be equated with the entirety of the sun, it's true, but the ray truly is light. And just so, the world that we deal with is always valid, is always true. So a school of thought that begins with the idea that yes, Brahman is real, that is perfectly sound. But this is a manifestation of that reality. In the Trika philosophy, and I think you have a representation of it in front of you in this diagram, you find that that supreme state of existence and consciousness is called Paramashiva and is unmanifest, is beyond all categories of conception. It is the ultimate, it is the absolute. But there is a spanda, a vibration that occurs within this reality. There marks a difference with Advaita Vedanta right there. Because for Advaita, that Brahman never moves, is completely a static, self-contained reality. But the tantrikas of the Trika philosophy say, no, there is an original vibration. It is a vibration of delight. It is a kind of tremor of delight that this vastness has within itself. And by dint of that, there is this manifestation of a biune reality. On one side is Shiva. Shiva is pure being, consciousness, chit shakti, conscious power. The other side of that is the shakti itself, ananda shakti. It is that quivering delight that brings into articulation the divine immensity. So the divine consciousness then establishes itself and says, I am this. That is the state of consciousness of Sadashiva. Icha Shakti, the power of the will to say, I am. Now, this is followed by another category in which this consciousness then says, this am I. So giving reality to that which it views. In the first, consciousness is primarily aware of itself. In the second, it is aware of the object of its consciousness. But as you can see, they're overlapped. They are one and the same thing still, but just a polarity has shifted within this one being. Then finally, there derives a balance between the two where that divine consciousness says, I am this. So it's, I am this, this am I am this. And that is the sadvidya, the knowledge that's based upon truth. And we have here a balance between the subject and the object. This, you might say, forms a higher universe. This is the first universe. This is creation within the mind, within the consciousness, within the awareness of the divine as a transcendence. Not the absolute transcendence of Paramashiva, but a kind of superconscient reality. As this continues to involve itself, the involution then pours itself through the measuring faculty of Maya. Now, Maya, unlike in Shankara, is not here a power of illusion, but is a power of the Shakti to make itself manifest. This is the focusing light, or the focusing lens, perhaps, through which the vast light comes down to point itself into universal production. And then there are five different jackets or coverings by which this reality conceals itself. They're called the kanchukas. One is the kala, which is a kind of secondary creatorship. Another is vidya, but this is not the supreme vidya that we met above. This is limited knowledge, but still a derived power of knowledge. And then comes raga, which brings passion into universal production. And then kala, which gives the rhythms of time. So we're no longer frozen in an eternal moment. Now we have moment after moment. We have succession from past into present into future. And then niyati, which is the power of destiny, which allows the universe to cohere. It is the application of a will force. And if you see, behind all of this is the Purusha consciousness, watching all of this play. This is yet a higher universe than the one that we actually experience. So you can see there are levels and levels of consciousness leading up to the Supreme. It is only as this conscious power continues to involve itself that we arrive at the Prakriti that we know from the Sankhya system. And from here on, Abhinavagupta and the other thinkers in this school accept the Sankhya terminology and roll out the rest of the tattvas. So now we have a total of 23 plus those that they've added. So we've got 36 or 37 tattvas if you count Paramashiva as a tattva. And it arrives through the combination of sattva, rajas, and tamas, and the interplay of the gunas into the creation of the buddhi, the intelligent will, of the ahankara, the eye-making consciousness, and the making of all the gross and subtle senses and objects that we deal with. That's what we're supposed to see at the very bottom. I'm not sure that you can see the little star and the moon, but that represents the physical universe that is apprehendable to us. So this is the whole chain of involution. Isn't it interesting? Because it's not as simple as the Sankhya, and it answers to more of the complexities of our spiritual experience as we rise in consciousness from state to state. More of that in a moment. But this is just the involving power of the Shakti as she moves into action, drawing the pure being of Shiva into manifestation. Everything is still Shiva. Everything is an empowerment by Shakti of that pure being. There is nothing that is absent the presence of the divine in the universe. So the world is real, objectively real. The senses, the objects of the senses, the mind, the ego, everything is drenched in reality. That's the involution part. The evolution part is when we start waking up, when we start coming back to a sense of ourselves. And that depends on the idea of anugraha, grace. Because the grace of the Lord, the grace of the divine, is there to stimulate us and make us start an adventure back from the base of creation to climb all the way up this ladder of being to recover what we are. And what that is a recognition of what we are. Pratyabhijna. The recognition that this I am. So the triad, the first triad, is that Shiva and Shakti and Nara are all interconnected. They are interdependent. Shiva represents pure being. Shakti represents pure power of being. Nara is the individual who is going to waken up to the reality that he is that. How does he do it? Guru and disciple, guru and shishya. It takes the grace of the divine acting through the teacher. Now, sometimes the teacher is a human, and sometimes the teacher is the divine himself or herself. So there are four ways, four means by which we come back to that. And the basic way is the anava upaya. Anava is how we start. We take postures, we take pranayama, we chant all of these things to prepare aspects of our being to accept the greater insight that they'll have to have. So it's a gradual beginning that leads us from the near to the far. The next is the shakta, which obviously draws upon the power of this great energy that controls the world and makes us enter into that power primarily through the use of a mantra, so that in the mantra we can discern the energy, the consciousness, the reality of what she represents. That leads us to a third upaya, which is called Shambhava, which is when the Lord himself sparks in you a recognition of what this is. And that is done not through the arresting of your attention anymore, like with the mantra recitation, not through trying to control the emotions and the body and the mind through the anava upaya, but rather through a gentle relaxing of the will, a gentle application of the will, is what I should say, so that you stay focused on what that reality is, and then the wall separating falls away, the veil is lifted. And there is a fourth way, which is that in the very rare disciple, there is no effort at all. There is simply the divine reveals itself, and the being is so ready that instantly he sees it. So there's little or no effort at all. So you can see there are graduated states by which we climb. Now, all of these tattvas that we're looking at, whether they're the impure tattvas of the graspable universe that we live in commonly, or the pure impure tattvas in the world above, or even beyond that, in the sort of the supracosmic world where the pure tattvas exist, all the tattvas are signposts. They're not simply philosophic principles that we talk about, but they are experienceable. So that as you're climbing from rung to rung on this great ladder of being, having studied this, having made it part of your swadhyaya, if I may, your self-study, studying yourself, studying the world is the same thing. As you study this and you experience, you come to know it through your experience that, this is what I am doing. This is the level that I am at. And so you climb in awareness and you climb with your fellow seekers, and always you're accompanied with the guidance and the blessings and the grace of the guru to get back to that. So the viewpoint that Abhinavagupta has, as opposed to Shankara, not that this is an illusionistic world, but that in a common sense way, you can think of the divine in the same way that you would think about what an experience of art is. Because if you look at a creative consciousness, and that creative consciousness decides, I will write a poem, I will compose a drama, I will choreograph a dance. And that thing comes into being. Well, it presents something of itself in the doing of the creation. But the act of creation does not exhaust everything that it is. So it both conceals and reveals at the same time. Just so, the world perhaps is measured out through the consciousness power of Maya, but the world really does reflect something of the values of the divine consciousness. There is much that is behind, much that is unexpressed. And so Abhinavagupta says, tracing the power of the word all the way back to the Veda, says, this is how reality comes into being. Just as the Rishi, in communion with the divine, conceives the word and then speaks the word, and reality comes into being because of that. Just so, this world manifests. There are four stages of the word. There's the supreme word, Paravak. There is Pashyanti Vak, that which is the seeing. There is Madhyama Vak, that which is in the middle. And there's finally Vaikari Vak, which is the gross word. So again, level after level after level of reality. The word begins in the supreme and is in a sense cognate with that first spanda that we talked about, that vibration of bliss. And then begins to articulate itself, develops a vision, creates an intermediary world through which that vision will be delivered, and then finally is uttered. And the utterance is the experienceable universe. So all that we experience is an exuberant affirmation of sensuous reality. The world is meant to be both beautiful and true. Now, when we're small, when we live encased in the ego and haven't recovered ourselves, the world can look terrible. And when we look at the divine, he seems like Maitreya, the god-awful god. But when we've grown, then that Maitreya becomes beautiful. So we're invited again to go from the near to the far, from the small to the large, from what seems not to be Shiva to what actually is Shiva. And this obviously is not the Shiva of the Trimurti, you know, Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva, one creates, one sustains, and one destroys. No, we're talking about a name that's given to this reality, but that reality cannot be subsumed to any personality conception. It is beyond that, but manifests itself as all this. Behind all personalities stands that one core conscious power. When we regard the power, we see it as Shakti. When we regard the pure being, we see it as Shiva. It is the same thing, the same reality. So, Abhinavagupta reminds us then that an aesthetic experience which exalts us, which draws us out of our ordinary consciousness, is like a mystical experience. This communion that we feel with the divine, where all the three elements become one, being, power, and individual. The difference, of course, is that the aesthetic experience, while it exalts us, at some point fades, and we return to our ordinary consciousness. The beauty of the siddhi, though, when we follow the yoga to completion and enter into full oneness with this conscious power, then there is no fallback into ignorance. One lives in bliss. There's a wonderful description of Abhinavagupta by his cousin and then great commentator, Kshemaraja, who says, there he sits in virasana, in the posture of the hero, and his hair is long and lush and garlanded with flowers. He is wearing white silk, looking like the snows of the Himalayas. On his lap is the veena, and he's playing beautiful music. Near him are yoginis, aspects of the Divine Mother, goddesses in human form, or yoginis becoming goddesses, but sitting near him. And his eyes are rolled up in bliss, and his complexion is rosy, soulful. And then around him are all the schools of philosophy. Everyone is represented there. The Kaula, the Tantrika. Everyone is sitting around him, recognizing that he indeed is the embodiment of all that wisdom. He has drunk from every stream. And in fact, Abhinavagupta studied every school of the Tantra to its completion, not just reading it, but realizing its core truth. So they say that Abhinavagupta is the greatest philosopher in India after Shankara. And some say that's cheating, Abhinavagupta. He's really the greatest philosopher of India. I might say that we might call him A.G. There was another A.G. a few centuries later. Sri Aurobindo used to be known as A.G. to his comrades before Mother said, no, you must call him Sri Aurobindo. He was just A.G. Now, if you take up this little PDF again, you'll see that there are some horizontal lines drawn across the page to mark out where the transcendence descends into universal manifestation that we know. And that in the sphere above, which is more a direct manifestation of Paramashiva, with the levels of Sadashiva, Ishwara, and Sadvidya, these bear close parallels to Sri Aurobindo's treatment of the supermind and the three levels of the supermind. Now, we're months away from getting to that when we begin our study of the life divine. But I want you to hold on to this paper because it will be of great use and interest to you. The very idea that Sri Aurobindo chose the term chit shakti when speaking about Satchit Ananda, that you can't say it is simply chit, it must also have power, it must be chit shakti, is a direct reverberation of Abhinavagupta's insights 1,000 years later, manifesting in his own. Abhinavagupta, I don't know if I've already said this, was born around 950 and left his body in 1025. They say that he went into the Bhairava cave with 1,200 of his disciples and disappeared, was never seen again. Unfortunately, the great school of Kashmir Shaivism would last only about another 300 years. It was exterminated by Muslim influence in the Northwest. And although people have claimed that Kashmir Shaivism has continued down into the 20th century, almost into the 21st, it's a pale reflection of what Abhinavagupta brought to us. Because for him, beauty was a means of deliverance and manifestation. That you could use art and song and dance as actual means of elevating your consciousness and attaining greater and greater states of communion with the divine until you reach that absolute. You could do it all beginning with that. And there is no school like that today. In Kashmir now, it is merely a relic of what it was. So I think I'll pause and see if you have any questions.